Morning. First case of the morning will be Barnett versus Ameren. Mr. Hammond.
Good morning, if it pleases the court. Plaintiff's case is a two-count action, one under ERISA, one under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act, challenging unilateral changes made in collectively bargained retiree health benefits in the form of cost shifting implemented on January 1st of 2004. It is our core position that there are latent and patent ambiguities in the governing documents entitling plaintiffs to trial and requiring reversal of the district court's summary judgment order. We also ask, in the event that the summary judgment ruling is reversed, that this court also reverse the district court's order denying class certification. Under Seventh Circuit case law, the dispositive issue in a case of this nature is whether the governing documents are ambiguous or not. From that standard, there are three categories of cases: those in which it's been held that the documents unambiguously established no vesting. UAW versus Rockford Powertrain would be a case in that category. In the Deal case, it was held that the governing documents unambiguously established vesting, so there the plaintiffs were entitled to judgment. And then there's the third category, Bidlack and Rossetto being examples, where the court has concluded that there were ambiguities in the governing document warranting a trial. The ambiguities entitling plaintiffs to a trial in a case of this nature can either be patent or latent. The patent ambiguities are those that are intrinsic to the governing documents themselves. The latent ambiguities are those that are extrinsic to the governing documents. Plaintiffs rely heavily on the rules set forth in this court's decision in Rossetto. Judge Posner summarized the rules towards the end of the decision. First, he said, if there is language in the governing documents suggesting a grant of lifetime benefits, then the plaintiffs are entitled to trial. That's obviously something short of language establishing the grant of lifetime benefits. There you would have the situation in Deal where the plaintiffs would be entitled to judgment. Even in the absence of such patent ambiguity, however, if there is objective evidence of latent ambiguities, that will entitle the plaintiffs to a trial, even where the contract is silent, the contractor governing documents is silent on duration, and even where there is durational language, such as life of the agreement or term of the agreement, again, if there is positive evidence of latent ambiguity.
Now, if there is a specific term, then usually they're usually about 3 years, aren't they?
Yes, sir. And collective bargaining agreements typically run 3 years.
And so your position is that the people who retired within that three-year period would have a permanent, I guess, vested right to continued benefits?
Yes, sir.
And that, regardless of those who are currently employed, they're contingent on the next CBA.
Their terms could be negotiated in the next contract negotiations.
Whereas, and you're saying that those who have retired during that time are vested.
Yes, sir.
And that's regardless of whether this is so-called, whether they call the disclaimer or what do you call the caveat? What
reservation of rights.
Reservation of rights, where they would then, I guess, be vulnerable. I guess that would be, in effect, the continued payment would be, I guess the company would say that was just a gratuitous extension.
A couple of points on that, Your Honor. First, it may be one thing to say benefits are gratuitously granted in a non-union setting where there's no collective bargaining. The idea that an employer would bargain for certain benefits and then on top of that gratuitously throw in additional benefits is, I think, somewhat counterintuitive in the real-world context of collective bargaining. A specific point in this case, the reservation of rights language is contained in summary plan descriptions that were unilaterally promulgated, not negotiated. The unions never agreed to that language. In fact, there's abundant evidence in the record that the unions consistently protested the insertion of that reservation language in the unilaterally promulgated summary plan descriptions.
We deal with about 71 or quite a number of actual CBAs, aren't we?
We're dealing with a large number of CBAs over the years.
That's what I mean.
Yes, sir.
There were two that actually, in writing, disputed that reservation of rights, as I understand it.
There were two plan documents, Your Honor, that were, in the case of SIPS, SIPS and Union Electric merged in 1997 to form Ameren. And then eventually the SIPS people were brought under the Ameren plan. In the 1995 and 1997 plan documents, which were negotiated, unlike the UE SPDs, the parties, if you will, put in their competing positions as to the vested character of the benefits. I would, if I could, Your Honor, like to focus on the 1993 negotiations between Union Electric and the Joint Bargaining Committee, which was the committee that bargained for all seven of the unions. Prior to 1993, neither retirees nor their dependents paid anything for health care, and that had been negotiated back as far as 1957. In 1993, because of FASB rules, the company wanted to have the retirees pay a portion of their dependent coverage. And these negotiations took a long, long time, traversed almost all of 1993. And this question of the retiree payment of the premium for the dependents was just central to the negotiations. And the associated issue of a cap on what they would have to pay. Originally, the company proposed that for persons retiring thereafter, this did not affect existing retirees, for those retiring thereafter, that they would pay 20% of whatever the premium was for their dependents with no cap. That was voted down by a 99-1 margin by the various employees. Then the company came back with a proposal, 20% with your maximum amount capped at three times what you went out with at retirement. That later came down to two times the amount of retirement, what was ultimately agreed to, and it was agreed that it would apply for folks retiring on or after 7/1/94. The stipulation which memorializes what was agreed to in these negotiations talks about people being entitled to benefits, qualifying for the benefits, if they have 10 years of vested service after age 45.
Vested in what? Pension?
The document doesn't say, Your Honor.
That's usually what it refers to, though, isn't it?
Vesting is a concept certainly well known to pension, but the term was used here in the context of retiree benefits. We think this is a patent ambiguity in the document. If we thought that it so conclusively established our case, then we would have contended we were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. We think at a minimum, though, that is a patent ambiguity, at least as in Rossetto, suggestive of a grant of lifetime benefits that justifies the resort to extrinsic evidence. And when you look at the negotiations, Your Honor, the argument that it was intended by the parties that this agreement only lasts for the term of the agreement, it doesn't hold up. In fact, the Joint Bargaining Committee proposed that the agreement on retiree self-pays for dependent coverage only go for the term of the agreement. The company rejected that proposal.
Counsel, what language is there in the documents that give any indication that these health benefits were vested?
First, we believe that the use of the term vested in the stipulation and then vesting in the follow-up supplementary agreements is by itself suggestive, not conclusively establishing, but suggestive of an intent to grant a lifetime benefit.
What specific language are you talking about?
If you need to pull that out, maybe you can do it in your rebuttal, because
yes.
I think you're going to run out of time here.
I see I am about to. The other point that I would make is that during the negotiations, it was stated that the importance of the cap was so that people would know what they would have to pay for the rest of their lives. And other representations were made by company officials during the negotiations, further suggesting that it was contemplated that these benefits would be on these terms for life.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wack?
May it please the court. The issue in this case, we submit, has already been addressed and decided by this court at least six times. Six decisions, two of which were decided by written by members of this panel. Judge Mannion wrote Murphy and Ryan. Another one was Sen, which was written by Judge Coffey. And the other three cases are Vallone, Rockford Powertrain, and Pabst versus Corral. And all those cases teach collectively that an express limitation on the duration of retiree health care or a valid reservation of rights by the employer to end or amend the plan eliminates any claim to vested benefits as a matter of law. That's the end of the inquiry, if that's the case. Now, in this case, there is not a single document, to answer your question, Your Honor, not one document anywhere in the record that mentions or refers to lifetime benefits or vested benefits. The important 1994 supplementary agreement, which is addressed at length in the briefs, two things about it. This appears at Defendant's Appendix 649. This is just one of them. There are separate ones for each union. This applies to active employees. With respect to employees for whom the company is recognized as the exclusive bargaining representative, that's only employees. The union wasn't representing any retirees in these negotiations. And then the second important point about the supplementary agreement is it says the company will continue to take such action as may be necessary to modify and to continue for the life of the labor agreement. And then it goes on and describes these caps and other benefits. The result of that is this. The only time there was ever any negotiation, at least within the realm of this lawsuit, I don't know about 1957, but within the realm of this lawsuit, was in this 1993-1994 period. And the agreement was made was for active employees who retired during the collective bargaining agreement from 1993 to 1996. If they retired during that period, they would have the benefit of this cap that's described here, and they would have that for the life of the labor agreement. When the labor agreement expired, they were simply retirees like everyone else. The unions weren't bargaining for them. They weren't negotiating for them. And they were subject to the terms, the unilateral terms of the plan which the company had established for retirees, which contained the summary plan description that said we can end or amend the plan at any time. That's the way that this thing worked.
So it's again a 3-year period usually, right?
Yes, sir.
And so a person who retires within that time has, I guess you say, guaranteed at least that retirement benefit only for the balance of that 3 years.
That's
correct.
Could
be 1 or 2 years then.
That's correct.
And then what are subsequent payments? The same thing I would ask him. Are those considered gratuitous?
Yes, because there were no subsequent supplementary agreements like the one I pointed out to you in 1996 or 1999 or any other year. This is the only one.
So you're saying the union bargains only on behalf of active employees.
There's no question about that. That's the uncontroverted evidence. They've all the union people testified to that, and that is clearly the case. They never bargained on behalf of retirees.
Well, most of the problem would be on dependents, I assume. Of course, you can get an early retirement at 55, I believe, under some of these.
Yes, sir.
And so that would be 10 years until Medicare, at least. And then dependents are, again,
well,
the main concern, I suppose.
Yeah, dependents would the union's certainly not bargaining on behalf of dependents, Your Honor.
Well, that's part of the... That's part of what they're getting, whether they're not bargaining on their behalf, but they do. That is part of
the dependents are treated the same way the retirees are.
Right.
And at the end of this agreement,
I don't know what happens to retirees' dependents when they go on Medicare. I don't even know. I'm gonna have to find that out.
Well, there's usually a coordination provision where the company pays part after Medicare and so forth.
Yeah.
I don't know that I understand all that, but that's all that ever happened here. And when Mr. Hammond describes the negotiations that took place, first of all, there's nothing in the record about a lot of that, but be that as it may, I would agree that there was a lot of confusion in the negotiations back in 1993. But the fact of the matter is, when they reached an agreement, this is what they came up with.
Yeah, what page is that again? You said 649?
This is page 649 of our appendix, and this is one of many.
Right.
This is between the company and three of the locals, 309, 649, mm-hmm. and 1439.
But that language, you think, is consistent through most of these agreements?
It is identical throughout all of these supplementary agreements that were made that year.
Okay.
And again, no later agreement that addresses this at all.
The idea is that any payments made after the three-year end of the collective bargaining agreement were gratuitous for people who retired within that.
Yes, I mean it's not like it was a gift. The company had established a plan, and it was unilateral plan, and they could change it because retiree health care, like all the other vested welfare benefits under ERISA, is not a vested right. It's not like a pension. It's something that could be changed all the time, and Congress made that decision.
What is it now? What goes on now? Is there a certain cap, and is there a certain copay?
Yeah, the way it worked, based on the change that was made here, by the year 2009, the retirees will be paying 25% of their costs and 50% of the dependents' cost.
Is that premium, meaning cost?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. That will be the net result of this change. When it began, the retirees weren't paying for any of their health care, and it was 20% of the dependents.
Is it your view that you could end it all and not make any have any payments?
Yes, sir. We could. I know that seems harsh, but that's simply what ERISA provides. If it's not vested, it's not vested, and we have the legal right to do that. I mean, there may be lots of other implications in terms of what that means to the company if it takes action like that, but that's not, I don't think, for any of us here to judge today. Company has the right to end or amend retiree health care at any time. I would also point out that the collective bargaining agreements themselves, the 71 that Your Honor mentioned, are all, in every case, talk about the medical plan for the life of the labor agreement. In other words, the medical plan that's provided in the course of those negotiations for active employees is only for the life of the labor agreement.
What is the difference in premium payment for active employees and retirees?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't know.
I assume that these days the employee pays some of it.
Yes, he does. I seem to have a recollection, and I'm reluctant to say this, but I seem to have a recollection that the retirees are being put on the same level as the actives are now.
Okay.
So you have labor agreements which provide a medical plan only for the life of the agreement itself, 71 of those. You have 10 SPDs which give the company the right to end or amend. You have the 1994 supplementary agreement, which I pointed out to you is for the life of the labor agreement. And on the other hand, you have no statement in any document about vested benefits or lifetime benefits.
Are these on the table? Were these negotiated? I mean, this issue of continuing health care after retirement.
You mean back to the 93, Your Honor?
In any labor negotiation with...
There has never been any negotiation where there was negotiation over benefits for people other than active employees. In other words, if you're... Is that what you mean?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
On the very issue, was there any vesting so there was continued right to benefits after the three-year contract?
No, sir. Absolutely not. You know, the only time there was any negotiation at all was in this 93 period. It was for actives who retired during that three-year period. At the end of that three-year period, that benefit, as a bilateral matter, was over. As to the issue of ambiguity, there is no ambiguity here. Latent ambiguity doctrine refers to a situation where there's some sort of where there's something outside of the document that renders it ambiguous, such as the Ship-Peerless case talked about in the brief. Here we have the words for the life of the labor agreement, right in the 94 supplementary agreement and in the collective bargaining agreements. And that can only mean one thing. There's no two ways to read that. So it doesn't make any difference how much extrinsic evidence you want to speak of. As to the 10 years of vested, it's not 10 years of vested service, it's 10 years of vesting service. And that is an eligibility requirement. That's how you get into rights to a pension. It is not an entitlement, a vested right to a pension. In fact, in their second amended complaint at page 23, and this is our appendix 0075, that's the way they pleaded. Plaintiffs described the 10 years of vesting service provision as an eligibility requirement. And you're right, Your Honor. It is a term that is typically used to determine pension eligibility. That's what it takes to get into the plan. That's what it takes to get into a pension plan. And it's no more than that. If the parties had intended to have vested rights, they would have used the word vested just as everybody else does. They wouldn't have been talking about 10 years of vesting service in order to be eligible to join the plan. On the subject of the so-called evergreen clause, which was pleaded here, that goes back to the point we were talking about earlier. If you're trying to evergreen something, you have to look at what you're evergreening. And what they want to say was evergreened here is retirement rights into the future. Well, you have to look at this agreement again. All you could ever do is evergreen that. And that is for active employees. It's for active employees only.
For the life of the agreement.
For the life of the agreement.
I guess what would be the result of this is that the retirees would have a bunch of, under the Barnett or whoever claim, they'd have a much better deal than the active employees if this were carried out. If
right.
The active employees are doing a significant copay.
Nobody contends that the active employees have any vested rights. The active employees do have copays, and they're being increased from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I would just conclude this way. This is a situation where, you know, Congress made a conscious decision to set the bar high whenever retirees claim vested rights to health care benefits. And it concluded that the reason for that is because health care benefits are uncontrollable, they're unpredictable, and, you know, there was a feeling that if those benefits were easily vested, the companies might not even want to establish these plans. And some of us might disagree with that determination, but that's what Congress decided, and that's what the case law says. The result in this case, Your Honors, works no injustice, because no collectively bargained right was ever taken away here. Prior to the 1994 supplementary agreements, the company only provided retiree health care unilaterally. And then after, in 1994, we've seen what happened then. And then for those active employees who retired during the period of one of these collective bargaining agreements, the summary plan descriptions took over where those labor agreements left off. So as a result, the company was free to amend retiree health care for existing retirees before 1994, during 1994, and after 1994. And there is simply no issue here. What the company did is consistent with ERISA, and it doesn't violate any contract between the parties, and the judgment below should be affirmed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hammond? You've got about 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. These negotiations in 1993, it's true they didn't involve then-retired individuals, but they did involve existing retirees, and it involved bargaining for what existing retirees would have into the future. And the issue here is whether they bargained beyond the term of the agreement in terms of what they would have in the future.
You're talking about existing retirees, those who retired under this
time? No, those who were already retired at the time of the 93 negotiations. The negotiations didn't cover them. It governed those who were to retire thereafter. And then the issue in this case is, what was agreed to? Did it transcend the term of the agreement? The stipulation drafted by Union Electric, signed on November 22nd, 1993, the day that the parties reached tentative agreement, provided, and they signed it, for the year 1995 and all subsequent years, required that the retiree pay 20% of the monthly dependent major medical premium and all subsequent years. In this stipulation that they drafted contemporaneously with reaching the agreement, there was no life of the agreement or term of the agreement language. That was added by them in the supplementary agreements signed about 6 weeks later. There were no 0.0 negotiations or discussions between November 22nd, when this stipulation, clearly contemplating something beyond the term of the agreement, was signed, and these stipulate in the supplementary agreements were signed in January.
What was the duration of that agreement that you refer to there? The one you just said in subsequent years.
The stipulation of November 22nd, 1993 is not durational. It says for the year 1995 and all subsequent years.
So that's
required that the
life of the company, as far as you're concerned.
Yes, or the life of a solvent company, perhaps you could say.
For sure. Or the life of the collective bargaining agreement.
That possibly could be argued, but I think then you have to refer back to the negotiations. And again, they gave examples when they sold this to the retirees, to the now retirees. When they sold it, they gave examples of how they would fare many years out, as far as 20 years out, under this new proposal, coupled with the pension enhancement that was a quid pro quo for this concession by the unions. Finally, I would make this point. Even the life of the agreement language that they added unilaterally to the supplementary agreements of January 1994 can be harmonized with the stipulation. We read, first we argue that those supplementary agreements have to be interpreted at a minimum in pari materia with the 1993 stipulation. And secondly, we respectfully and vigorously assert that it has to be interpreted with reference to the contract negotiations. We believe that that term of the agreement language identifies the class of people governed by those changes. Those retiring during the term of that contract are governed by that, but as the bargaining shows, they have it for life. And it left open for the parties to negotiate different terms for those retiring under subsequent collective bargaining agreements. That was never done.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Did you find that language vesting?
The language says in the stipulation, Your Honor, of 1122-93, it says require 10 years vested service after age 45 to be eligible for post-retirement medical and life insurance. It was slightly different in the supplementary agreements. It said 10 years vesting service. Vesting as opposed to vested.
Thank you.
Thanks very much to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.